a best-selling novelist took a job at a big-box store, was shocked by what she found, and decided to write a novel about it.
One thing was important to me to paint in the book is I don't think my employer was particularly evil. It was not great, but it was part of a system, and I think we have to look at the system. Do we want a system that is this, I'm not even going to call it efficient, because I think that firing a full-time worker with benefits in order to hire two part-time workers at lower cost is not a real efficiency. It's just a way of taking corporate profits that used to go to workers and giving them to shareholders. It's not really making anything better except for shareholders get more money. But I think we have to look at the system and the incentives, because I think it's something that for most of us, we learn about it. It's morally repugnant.
That's Adele Waldman. We talk with her about her new novel, Help Wanted. It's about what happens when a group of workers at a big box store scheme to get their overbearing manager promoted out of their department. Along the way, it reveals what work life is really like for millions of low-wage workers in today's economy. Then we remember Paul Auster, who died on April 30th at the age of 77. We air our 2008 conversation with Auster about his novel, Man in the Dark. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Adele Waldman always thought she would dedicate her writing career to penning fiction about the love affairs of the upper middle class, like her literary hero, Jane Austen. Her best-selling first novel, The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P., published in 2014, fit that mold. But her new novel, Help Wanted, breaks it. Instead of skewering the absurdities of the Brooklyn literati, it shines a light on the odds low-wage workers are up against in today's economy. And those odds are daunting, as Waldman discovers when she took a job at a Target store to find out how those workers really live. Despite the success of the Fight for 15 movement, which moved many major retailers like Walmart and Target to raise their hourly wage to $15 an hour or even a few dollars more, real yearly wages are worse now than they were 20 years ago. Why? Because most non-management retail jobs are now part-time without benefits. With a richly drawn cast of characters, Adele Waldman's novel Help Wanted is a funny, moving tale of ordinary people just trying to make a living. Adele Waldman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, Francesca. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So this novel, Help Wanted, follows your previous novel, The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. That grew out of a very different zeitgeist. Michelle Goldberg of the New York Times called that novel a picture-perfect description of, quote, Obama-era literary Brooklyn and the Ivy-educated cads. This one is a picture-perfect description of what it's like to work in a big-box store. Very much a novel about the working class and the hidden injuries of the working class, hidden because so few people actually really write about them. What brought you to this topic, and how did you get it so real?
Well, it's not something I would have expected to write 10 years ago after I published The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. I always thought I wanted to write psychological novels about the problems of middle and upper middle class people, about their romantic problems. I love Jane Austen, a novelist who wrote six excellent novels about courtship that I think stand up and are some of the best novels ever written. I thought it was a valid subject, and I still think so. But to my surprise, something happened. I would say 2016 was the turning point. I don't know if you recall, but we had a presidential election, and the results were surprising to some of us, at least to me. And I felt jolted out of a sense I think I'd had previously that that we lived in a fairly stable, fairly just society, that it's not as if I thought it was perfect, but I thought it was healthier and more fair than I've come to think it was. But what that did for me in 2016, my interest just turned much more to politics and to the state of the country. And I felt like I just wanted to get out of my world with its limited preoccupations some. And what I decided to do was apply for jobs, low-wage jobs. And I thought that maybe I would write about it, but I didn't know exactly what would come from it. And I got a job at a big box store. And within a few weeks of working this job, I felt sure that I wanted to write a novel about it. And I think there were two elements that really drew me to it. One is just, it turns out a big box store in the middle of the night, which is when I was working, is an environment that I think is rich with novelistic pathos and comedy. I came in usually at 4 a.m. with my coworkers to unload the trucks of new merchandise that arrived at the store each night. And then we would try to get all the new items onto the store shelves before the store opened at 8. And so if you picture being in a big box store in the middle of the night, it's closed to customers, the lights are dim, you're with a group of people of all different ages, races, ethnicities, genders, and you're kind of cracking jokes to make it more fun. And it's just, it was full of comedy. There's something kind of inherently fun about that setting. And I thought some of my coworkers were just really cool and really funny and just fun to be with. I liked them a lot. And so that had some novelistic appeal. And then at the same time, there was this other element of economic exploitation, which, to be honest, was worse than what I expected. It's not like I took a job at a big box store thinking my coworkers were going to be, you know, living the life of Riley and driving fancy cars and going on vacations all the time. But what I didn't fully understand is the way our employer, like many, many other chain retailers and food service companies, has switched to an economic model of making all low-level employees part-time. And what that means is that employees' hours are completely variable. There's no stability. It's just a matter of how many people the store thinks it needs at a given point. There's no sense of you're on the hook to provide everyone with 20 hours a week because they need that much money to pay their rent. Someone might get 8 hours of work one week and 39 hours the next week. Never 40 because they never wanted to approach overtime. And it just made life for my coworkers impossible. It makes it impossible to get an auto loan, to rent an apartment, to plan ahead. They had to live with so much anxiety. And then it also makes it very hard to get a second job because we're told the way to increase the hours you get at the first job is to keep your availability open. So if hours become available, they'll be able to call you in. But it's just a catch-22. So it's most of my coworkers did work second jobs, but it was just a lot of trade-offs and wrangling. And I felt that these two elements, both the fun of the store and the degree to which I thought my coworkers were being really just exploited beyond what I think most of us intuit might be happening, that there were just so few opportunities to move up and so little reciprocity in terms of our employer showing minimum care for the fact that its workers are people and they have children and they have to pay rent and they have to buy food, etc.
Yeah, I want to come back to this point because in this book, in this novel, Help Wanted, you make it so real. I mean, the actual consequences in the stories of each of the people, different stories that really do illuminate different parts of this. But it was so obvious that you loved your characters, and they are so finely drawn. So tell us about a few of them. First of all, Nicole, who kind of starts the book. I'm going to ask you, I mean, there are so many, but I'll ask you about Nicole, Little Will, Val, Diego, Ruby, and Meredith. I'm not sure we'll get to all of those, but I guess start wherever you'd like to with them.
Sure. No, I'm delighted. Thank you. I'm so glad you asked about that because as you said, I love the characters so much. It's really means a lot for me to talk about them. And for me, it came out of with my first novel, The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. There was a single protagonist, and the point of the book, one of the major points, was to capture his psychology in a way I thought was fair, but that would also was simultaneously a criticism of his psychology and sort of held it to the light in a not particularly favorable way. I just had a very different impulse with this book, where if I that same analytical energy went into capturing the store and the system. I wanted to be very fair and realistic about the nature of the job and the low-wage work environment and not exaggerate and make the employer comically or exaggeratedly evil, but just capture the catch-22 of working at the store correctly. But with the characters themselves, I wasn't interested in mocking them in that way. I felt that energy was reserved for the store. So I love all the characters, so I'm so glad you said that. And I guess I will start with Nicole as well, who does open the book. And she's a young woman. She's one of the youngest people on the team. She's 23. She has a baby. She lives with her fiance. And she is one of those people who she gives off an air of boredom and free-floating hostility, I say. She's not very friendly. She's not enthusiastic. But she, this gives her a certain sort of cachet that she's like, maybe she's a little bit like Aubrey Plaza's character on, oh shoot, what's that show set in Pawnee, Indiana? But a character who, because she feels a bit insecure about her place in the world, it's safer for her to be unenthusiastic, negative, give off this sort of air of hostility. And it works a little. She's got this. People respect her. They're a little bit afraid of her. But then internally, she's also a person who she's 23, but she has taken a lot of pride in the fact that she was a cool kid in high school. And only now is she starting to feel like that's not gonna carry her that much farther any longer. That she's getting too old to be taking pride in her status from high school, and she doesn't really know what is next. And she's very proud of the fact that on her performance review, the store manager told her she was very smart and had potential. And that was something I really, really noticed and felt touching about my coworkers when I worked at the store, that they got so little recognition for what they did, that they really took performance reviews quite seriously. And I think there's this human need to feel that you're valued, to feel that you're intelligent and you're contributing. And I think it was easy for me to go into the store as a upper middle class person, thinking that everyone's attitude would just be sort of negative about the store and ironic and think it was all a joke. But that was just my own preconceptions. For a lot of my coworkers, they were proud of working at a famous store, and those compliments, being told that they were important, was meaningful. So Nicole, for all her hard external shell, is sort of very, very proud that the store manager thinks she's smart. And she also toys with the idea of maybe applying to college or maybe applying for a better job at UnitedHealthcare, the sort of only major employer in town that's not kind of retail or food service. But she's also very, very afraid of being rejected or being laughed at, because again, she has that insecurity. It's easier for her to pretend she doesn't care and radiate negativity than to be vulnerable.
Well, let me interrupt you there for a minute, because you're touching on a theme that I did want to get to, which is the whole way that the store uses educational level as an exclusionary means of sorting its employees. I mean, if you don't have a GED, I guess you can't get any kind of promotion, but you cannot be promoted to manager if you do not have a college degree. Is this right?
Right. The lowest level manager job you need a GED for. The next level you need a college degree for. And I think it was fascinating and horrifying being at the store to see how pervasive this was. And I think one of the reasons for it, honestly, is that a store like this and many chain retail employers, they need many, many more grunt workers than they need managers. So they actually need ways of sorting people. They need reasons to not give people jobs because there's no way to reward all the people who are hardworking and competent in the current structure. And so in order to make it look more fair and less arbitrary, they use these educational criteria. But not only do I think that is very arbitrary and very hard on people who work hard, have lots of experience, but just are not qualified because they don't have that piece of paper, even though it's not relevant to the job. Not only is that troubling, but it also is just a way of concealing the fact that there's just not that many opportunities to move up. And if you do move up, being a store manager is actually a pretty well-paid, the store manager at the top level, the manager of the whole store, or the next level right underneath, in the book I call it the executive managers. Those are solid middle to upper middle class jobs. Like there is opportunity, but it's just a tiny, tiny pipeline. And it's just 99% of the store workers are, no matter how hard they work, are not going to be able to make it through that little pipeline. And that was one of the things I found most frustrating when I was there. I think I had sort of believed something I'd been told, that in our economy, if people work hard and are reliable and do a good job, that they will be rewarded for that, that employers are really eager to attract and retain good employees. And what I saw just contradicted that to such a degree that my coworkers were so reliable. Our shift started at 4 a.m. I thought that was early enough, but people would get there at 4:15 to put their stuff away in lockers and be ready to clock in at exactly 4:05, because that's when corporate allowed us to clock in and get an extra 5 minutes of pay. And that was the work environment. It wasn't showing up late. It was showing up early. Once I got a speeding ticket on my way to work because I was running late, and I just didn't want to show up late, not because my manager would get mad, but because I just would have been embarrassed with my coworkers because everybody showed up on time. And I would have been holding back the process of unloading the truck. Someone would have had to cover for my position. But so to see how hard people were working and just how few opportunities there were for advancement was one of the most troubling things about being there, honestly.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Adele Waldman about her new novel, Help Wanted. And so give us the example of Ruby with this. Ruby is an older woman. She's Black. You really bring in, I mean, not only the hidden injuries of class, but the hidden injuries of class, race, and gender, this intersectionality. I mean, Ruby wants to go to college. She wants to be a manager. She was the manager at a different store, not a big box store, but a local store before she got this job. Talk about her case and what it says about how the system is stacked against people.
Oh my gosh, yes. Ruby is, to me, one of the most compelling characters. She is sort of, in some ways, socially, she is very different from Nicole, even though they're very close friends. But Ruby is outgoing and social and friendly with everyone. If Nicole sort of kind of tries to be cool by being unfriendly, Ruby is, she's just warm and funny and outgoing, and people like her. She's got kind of like a stage presence. But she nurses many secret sadnesses. And one is that she had a job as an assistant manager at a fast food restaurant, and she loved that job. She was so proud to be assistant manager. Not only was the pay and just the stability was hugely helpful, but it was validating to her. She, someone who felt that she had leadership skills and intelligence, and this was the first time she had a position commensurate with what she felt like were her abilities. Then ultimately, she lost that job when the store got a new manager who she perceived with good reason as being racist, and she felt like he was looking for a reason to undermine her. And the truth is, Ruby is someone who has difficulty reading and writing, and she was afraid her boss would find out and humiliate her and fire her, and thought it was wiser to quit that job rather than wait for that to happen. So she did that, and it was with great sadness. And she came to the big box store, which has many, many problems, but it does have a more progressive management style. And I wanted to sort of be fair about that, that it is valuable for the employees of the store, doesn't tolerate racism, has a very zero tolerance policy as far as sexual harassment, which is something the characters had experienced in other jobs. And that is something. Unfortunately, it just also coincides with this lack of economic opportunity. But ultimately, Ruby is ineligible for a promotion at the big box store because she doesn't have her GED. And in my mind, I want the reader to feel that as a tragedy, or at least to the extent that I do. There's a point toward the end of the book where her son and daughter-in-law are coming to visit, and she asks to borrow $20 from a coworker to get a manicure because it's so important to her to present as successful to her children. She's raised three children, and she's always worked so hard, and she wants to greet her son and daughter-in-law with manicured fingernails. And I think that, I don't know, I think a reader would have to be a monster not to sympathize with her and just to feel like, my gosh, she should be able to afford a manicure and something that is technically a luxury, but someone who's nearing 50 years old, who's been working these kinds of jobs for more than 30 years, works hard, is a valued employee, and to not be able to afford the most basic small luxury in order to support her, just her psychological need to just have something to show for all her years, to me, I hope is as effective to readers as it felt in my mind.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Adele Waldman about her new novel, Help Wanted. You mentioned Ruby can't afford even the small luxuries, but a lot of people working at the store that's in this book, and by the way, the store pays better than many other stores do.
Right, right. That's one of the reasons that the workers stay at this store, because it pays $1 or $2 more than minimum wage, and that is practically important and also is a bit of a source of pride. So it's kind of a very sad version of velvet handcuffs.
But they can't even afford the necessities. A lot of these workers have to walk to work along a busy highway. Some of them have got not characters in the book, but characters refer to other store employees who were killed by cars, you know, hit by cars walking along a busy highway in the morning, in early in the dark, in the morning or later. They can't afford rent. They can't, you know, they have to go on to food stamps. They have to go on to Medicaid. What is the wage that people, I'm not saying the exact hourly wage, but I mean, what do people end up making in these low wage positions, you know, as an annual income, just so people understand what that means?
Right. No, it varies so much because of the issue of the hours. But and I want to come back to that because it's so key. It's the hourly wage is not so bad, but someone's annual income is determined by two numbers, right? It's your hourly wage times your number of hours worked. And because these jobs are part-time and because there's no obligation of the employer to provide any stability, and the employers often are very deliberate about making sure people don't work enough hours per week to qualify for benefits, and different retailers have different levels for what qualifies for benefits, an average of 30 hours a week for a calendar year, or an average of 25 hours a week for a calendar year. And then the stores make an effort to make sure that a lot of people will not work enough hours per week to be eligible for those benefits. And I think it's something that outside of this world, there's not enough awareness of the. I'm all for the fight for 15. I think the fight for 20 with inflation is more apt. It's very important. But if you make a couple more dollars per hour, but still only work 8 hours one week, it's not going to help you that much to make $2 more per hour. That's an extra $16. The bigger factor for my coworkers, which I had no idea until I was at the store, is about the number of hours worked. And I think that's something we could address legislatively to not allow employers to game the system this way, to only offer part-time work, to hire two part-time workers for instead of one full-time worker. But as a result of this part-time work, and I think sometimes too, when people from white-collar world hear part-time work, they might think it's someone sitting down with their manager being like, I have a child in school. I'd only like to work from 10 a.m. to 3 a.m. when to 3 p.m. when my child is in school. Is that, can we do that? This is not what we're talking about. This is, the employees have no say in their hours. It's just whatever hours they get assigned, they come. It's not coming to some mutually agreeable number of hours that works with their schedule. And in any case, it's because of this, some of my coworkers made $10,000 a year at this job. Then they would have the other jobs. Someone worked at a grocery store in the evenings, which she could do because our job was rooted in the early mornings, but her sleep would just be so strange and erratic. But that was able to work for her because the grocery store job only wanted her in the evenings. It would be like 5 to 11, and our job would always be the mornings, but sometimes an overnight shift. So sometimes she'd work 5 to 11 at the grocery store and then come to our store and do a midnight to 8 a.m. shift, which would have been very hard to do if she had had young children living with her at that point. Other people did a lot of gig work. They worked as, some of the guys just worked as movers or landscaping, and just all sorts of ways of trying to make extra money. And of course, food stamps and Medicaid were very important as well. But truly, what people made would be as little as $10,000 to $20,000 a year. And I think it's very, it's little understood outside this world, because I think some of us from the white collar world, we might hear an hourly wage of $15 an hour, multiply that by 40, thinking people work 40 hours a week, multiply that by 52, and it comes out to something that's not great. Maybe I forget that what that comes down to, maybe $30,000 a year. It's not great, but it's a lot better than 10. But unfortunately, because of the issue of the part-time work, what they're actually bringing home from this job is so, can be so little.
It's really shocking. And this is a new thing. There was a time when to work at a big box store didn't bring you a lot of money, but you were pretty assured of having a 40-hour week, 52 weeks of the year, or at least something pretty close to that.
Right.
The loss of benefits has been tremendous. Talk about that and talk about why this came about. Talk about the impact of the store that is unnamed, but everybody knows it's Amazon.
Was something I learned from my coworkers, and I don't know if I would have intuited or known in advance, but that the only people who had full-time jobs were either managers or people whose full-time status had been grandfathered in because they had been at the store in an earlier time when having a job like this in the 90s and the early 2000s was not a path to, you know, wealth and luxury, but a stable job, like the basis of a somewhat middle-class life, maybe a lower middle-class life, especially if you had a partner who was also working. People worked 40 hours a week. They could also sign up to work overtime when they wanted more money, and overtime pays time and a half. It was a solid lower middle class job. And that has just changed in the past 20 years. Some of that, I think, has to do with trade with China and price pressures that went that way, where there's so much price pressure on the stores, starting with Walmart, that is very aggressive about its low prices. And then other stores have to compete, and it just means that you're just like, these stores are trying to cut costs wherever they can in order to stay afloat. And then it really accelerated with the rise of online retail, because online retail has so many fewer costs in terms of maintaining these stores. And Amazon is also a very ruthlessly efficient employer. And the end result, a company like mine that had once prided itself on being a good employer, its strategy was to pay better than its competitor, to pay employees better than its competitors in order to attract and retain a good, loyal workforce that would make the customer experience of shopping at the store more pleasant. And I think lots of us as customers remember that about this particular store. But it's just, it became unsustainable in the current environment. And we live in an environment where the, you know, business media and stock analysts, all they focus on is quarterly profits. And so as companies slash benefits, take full-time positions and convert them to part-time, you know, they're being cheered on for doing the right thing because they're becoming more efficient and, you know, keeping up with these quarterly profit numbers. And I think that we have to look at the larger system and the incentives, because one thing was important to me to paint in the book is I don't think my employer was particularly evil. It was not great, but it was part of a system. And I think we have to look at the system. Do we want a system that is this, I'm not even going to call it efficient, because I think that firing a full-time worker with benefits in order to hire two part-time workers at lower cost is not a real efficiency. It's just a way of taking corporate profits that used to go to workers and giving them to shareholders. It's not really making anything better except for shareholders get more money. But I think we have to look at the system and the incentives, because I think it's something that for most of us, we learn about it. It's morally repugnant.
You know, Adele Waldman, I was thinking as I read the book, because you do go into so much detail that I think is really important, as a matter of fact. I read one review that complained about it being, I think it were, used the word too didactic or something. And I was saying, like, no, I think people really do want to read about the real lives of real people so they can have an understanding of why people, why Americans are feeling so insecure in this so-called, you know, thriving economy. It isn't reaching to them. And I also found that, I mean, the book was just great to read. It was a great read. The characters are so compelling. Did this change things for you in what you want to write about going forward?
It did. And at this point, I'm so focused on these policy issues related to part-time work. My plan at this moment, I'm actually going to work with someone who is a policy analyst, and we're going to write a policy paper together about this idea I have for addressing what I consider the misuse of part-time workers. And I'm very excited about that, because it's hard for me at this moment to, I don't know, to turn back to fiction. I just feel as if ever since I worked at the store and I've been working on this book, there have been many things I've wanted to say that I just wanted to get out there about what it's like for way too many working Americans. And I don't know what will happen next. I'm very glad to be doing this policy paper. There's something I'd like to write about narratives around labor. There's a way I think that the upper middle class has been a little more complicit than I think we'd like to think in the decline of unions. We've accepted a narrative for a while. I feel like many people in my cohort seem to accept a narrative that unions have been necessary in the past, back in the age of coal miners and steel workers. But now we live in this knowledge economy and they're passé. And, you know, I think that we were kind of sold a bill of goods and we accepted it. And I think that's been very bad for our society, and specifically for people like my coworkers whose lives would be much better, I think, if they were in a union or had a union to represent them. So I guess it's a long way of saying, for me, I don't know what comes next. At this point, I'm a little bit more focused on the policy issues than fiction. And I wish I knew what came after.
Well, I mean, I think that that's a great thing to come next after this, and kind of a no-brainer, because the passion of your real experience, in the best sense of the word, really comes through in this wonderful novel, Help Wanted. Thank you, Adele Waldman, for talking with us about this book.
Well, thank you so much, Francesca. This was really terrific and meaningful for me. I'm so glad you responded to the book this way on various levels. Just thank you.
Read or listen to an excerpt from Help Wanted by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we pay tribute to novelist Paul Auster by listening back to our conversation with him in 2008. He died April 30th. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I opened the New York Times this morning to the following headline. Paul Auster, the patron saint of literary Brooklyn, dies at 77. I was immediately transported back to the dimly lit studio at WMUA in Amherst, Massachusetts, where in 2008 I spoke with Auster via phone about his novel Man in the Dark. Writer's Voice was only 4 years old then, and I was thrilled to have scored an interview with an author the Times obit called one of the signature New York writers of his generation. In Auster's memory, let's listen to that conversation now. Paul Auster says that writing is no longer a matter of free will for him. It's a matter of survival. His new novel, Man in the Dark, deals with issues of survival in a post-9/11 America, the survival of hope, of connection with others, of choice in the face of evil, and, finally, of the stories that knit families together. His protagonist, August Brill, is a retired critic. He's in mourning both over personal tragedies and the loss of the familiar world he grew up in. He lies in bed, unable to sleep, filled with thoughts of his late wife and the horrific murder of his granddaughter's fiancé. Groping toward new meanings after the loss of the old, he wants to tell his granddaughter the story of his marriage, a story he hopes that can re-knit the world for them. Instead, he begins by telling a story to himself about a dystopian America in an alternate reality. That parallel America split off from ours after the 2000 presidential election, when the U.S. Supreme Court awarded George W. Bush the presidency. Paul Auster is the author of numerous novels, screenplays, and works of nonfiction, including Travels in the Scriptorium, The Invention of Solitude, and The Brooklyn Follies. He's also a poet, translator, and film director. Well, Paul Auster, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Your book, Man in the Dark, is a kind of postmodern narrative in the sense that it's told from different literary realities. You know, there's a protagonist, August Brill, who's a writer. There's Brill's character in a story he's making up. But because Brill is talking in the first person for the reader, that is for me, there's also you as a meta-author. The book starts out, I am alone in the dark, turning the world around in my head, and I couldn't help but feel but that was your voice, too.
Well, it's Brill. It's Brill. You know, being a novelist is often being a kind of actor, and you inhabit somebody else, and you speak through him, or he speaks through you. I don't know what's correct, but it is a fiction.
And the title of that fiction is Man in the Dark. You know, I was thinking of that title as a double entendre. Is it a double entendre?
Absolutely. I'm glad you saw it.
Could you say more about that?
Well, I mean, the book is one single man who happens to be named August Brill lying in the dark in a house in Vermont. But when you say man, that can also mean mankind, doesn't it? And in the dark can mean you don't know anything. And so maybe it's both. And I want the resonance of the two meanings of the title to be in the reader's head.
Yeah, and Brill, he's a man in his early 70s. He's a retired book critic. He's recovering from a car accident and also from his wife Sonia's death from cancer. And there are also two other people in his house who are wounded souls, if I can call them that. His daughter Miriam, who we don't really hear much about, and his granddaughter Katya. Katya's boyfriend was murdered in a particularly horrible way, which I won't reveal now. But it seems to me like that you're intersecting private and public tragedies here.
Well, exactly. I mean, the book does deal with rather large, even apocalyptic political issues. And it's also a very intimate book about families and marriage and the small things about life and what makes life, I suppose, worth living. And so it's both things at once.
Could you say more about that?
Well, it's simply that Brill is lying in his bed. It's one of those nights when he's not able to sleep. when he can't sleep, he lies there making up stories, mostly to entertain himself, but also to allow himself not to think about things he doesn't want to think about. Because there are many hard memories that have been preying on his mind, and he just simply doesn't want to think about those things. So he invents these fictions to distract himself. On this particular night, the story he invents is about a man named Owen Brick, who wakes up in a hole somewhere, he doesn't know where, and has a soldier's uniform on, and eventually learns that he is a corporal in an army fighting a civil war in the United States of America, which is happening now. And the cause of this civil war was the 2000 election results, when Bush stole the election from the Democrats. And it's a parallel world that Brill invents. And I think, in a sense, this this idea probably came to me because of my own outrage with the 2000 elections, which I looked at as a kind of coup that took place in the United States, one of the worst tragedies that we've ever experienced. And I've had this feeling ever since that we're living in a parallel reality, that the world isn't the real world anymore. The real world has Al Gore as president. There's no war in Iraq, and there might not have been 9/11. It's perfectly possible, because I do think the Clinton administration was on to what was going to happen, and they might have been able to prevent it, possibly. So anyway, all these thoughts, which have been building up in me for quite a few years, came pouring out in this parallel universe that I invent by way of Brill's imagination.
So in reality, the way you feel is that the world we're in is the parallel reality, and that's the world of fiction in your novel, but in an even more intensified state.
Yeah. Well, it is an eerie world we're living in now, and there's something that almost feels unreal to me about it. So I guess I'm trying to convey that in the book. But then again, as I said, there are other things, and because we don't listen to this story or read this story continuously, there are repeated interruptions. Brill has to cough, he thinks about something, he hears a sound, and he begins thinking about his granddaughter, Katya. They've been watching a lot of movies together. She's a film student, and the discussions of these films that they have are an important part of the book, and I think early on they lay the groundwork for what happens later, the more intimate stories that Brill begins to tell. And by the last quarter of the book, I suppose it's about a fourth, maybe a third, Katya comes downstairs. She can't sleep either. And she comes into Brill's room, lies down in bed next to him, and then they have a long, long conversation. So the book really takes an abrupt turn at that point.
It certainly does. I'd like to go back to the first part of the book, the story within the story. As you say, this character, this fictional character that Brill is making up in his head, Owen Brick, finds himself at the bottom of a hole.
It's an absolute situation. You wake up somewhere and you don't know where it is. You don't know where you are. And you're in a hole and you can't get out. Well, Brick does get out. Someone helps him out the next morning. And then his adventures in this alternate America begin.
And describe that alternate America.
Well, as I said, it's a country that has split. And state after state has seceded and formed something called the Independent States of America. The three states on the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, and California, have formed a new republic called Pacifica. And there's a lot of fighting going on. Many millions of people have been killed. And it seems that, as the story develops, that the war is controlled by one man. The war is in somebody's head. And at first, you're not sure who this person is, but then little by little, it becomes Brill himself. So Brill somehow manages to entangle himself in his own fiction. As he says, you know, does it mean that the fiction has become more real, or have I become a figment myself? He's not even sure. But he becomes more and more engaged himself with the thing that he's invented. And I think you can read this story and his involvement in it and this idea that he himself must be killed as a reflection of his own state of mind. It's almost a psychological portrait by way of a story, and a rather extreme story at that.
It is a very extreme story, very dark as well. And this man, Owen Brick, is a simple man. He's a magician.
Yeah, but not a famous magician, just a magician who does performances for children and old people's homes. Just a guy trying to make a living.
Right. And he confronts a real moral dilemma. His mission is to kill August Brill.
Yes, yes. And August Brill, of course, is in the other world, not this parallel world, the so-called real world. And so they do send him back to that real world to go after Brill. And then more adventures ensue when he's back.
I don't
want to give away too much.
No, I don't want to give away too much either. But he does confront a moral dilemma, I mean, without kind of revealing the ending here. And that's a dilemma that I think, you know, we do face in war, that soldiers face all the time, and that is to kill or be killed.
Yeah, exactly. So he's in a terrible bind, and there really is no solution. Brill solves it for him in a rather exacting and cruel way, I must say, but the problem is resolved. That story does end. And then Brill is still there. We're just around in the middle of the book, maybe a little farther, and he starts thinking of other stories. And then Katya comes into the room, finally. And then we take that sharp turn I mentioned earlier.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're speaking with Paul Auster about his new novel, Man in the Dark. Yeah, and about that sharp turn, it almost seems as if you abandon the story of Owen Brick. I mean, there is an ending, but it's kind of abrupt. It's dashed off. It's as if that story has done its job. And what was its job?
The job was to keep Brill going through the better part of the night. So in a sense, it has occupied his thoughts, and therefore it has been a success. He has, of course, lapsed into thinking about the things he doesn't want to think about, or at least some of them, but he's always managed to be able to pull his mind back into the story he's telling.
He has. The story seems to be an anodyne to begin with. That is something that keeps him from thinking about his real sorrows. But it's such a dark story that I wonder if it actually sharpens his sorrows.
I don't think so. I think when he's in the story, he's energized, and feeling the wheels turn in his head gives him some pleasure, I think. And dark stories aren't necessarily impossible stories, and sometimes confronting tough things has a salutary effect rather than a depressive one.
Right. I mean, it kind of reminds me of, people telling stories around the campfire. You know, that image in the mind of the world in the dark, the menacing world, and people telling each other stories. Mm-hmm. That's, in fact, what he's doing with his granddaughter.
Yes, yes. And I think the tenderness of his feelings toward this girl, you know, it's very important. It's sort of the essence of the book. And his more complicated but nevertheless intensely loving relation with his daughter, who's a professor, and she's divorced. Her husband left her 5 years earlier, so she's in going through tough times as well. And so they're all trying to help one another. And I think by the end of the book, there is some hope. I think there is something positive about where we've come, where we are at that moment, at least for the three main characters.
What is he transmitting to his daughter in the story? He really wants to tell her the story of his marriage.
His granddaughter.
His granddaughter.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, she's curious. She wants to know the facts because he had a complicated but very long marriage. He got married very young, in his early 20s, and he lived with his wife for, I think it's 18 years, and then they split up and divorced, and they're apart for about 9 years, and then they got back together again and lived together until she died. So it's a complicated story, and he tries to tell it to his granddaughter so she'll understand what the story really was.
And as you say, one of their favorite activities is watching movies together. She's studying film, and she talks about inanimate objects as expressing human emotions.
Well, the stories in films often use, the best films, inanimate objects as a way of expressing human feeling. And so that he cites a discussion they had had earlier that evening about, she gives three examples, three different films that they had seen. And they're very well-known films, Grand Illusion by Renoir, The Bicycle Thief by De Sica, and The World of Apu by Sajid Ray. Three of my favorite films, I have to say.
Mine too, as a matter of fact.
Good. they're just the masterpieces, all of them. Yeah. And each one, there are very important scenes in which objects do the talking, so to speak. So Kaja had stumbled upon this as a theory. And then later on in the book, Brill thinks of another example from another film they saw, Tokyo Story by Ozu. The scene right at the end of the film with the watch, when the old man gives his daughter-in-law the watch that belonged to his wife. And it's, have you seen that film?
No.
It's one of the greatest films imaginable. And that is one of the great scenes, I think, of all time, and well worth watching.
You know, I was thinking about those three films because, as I just said, those are also my favorite. Actually, I think Grand Illusion is my favorite film. They all share such a profound compassion for humanity.
Yes, and they're all very intimate stories, you see, and that's the territory that the book later goes into. And I think by discussing it so early, the reader's probably primed for other things to be happening besides the brick story later.
Right, and they do. The stories do move between these different spheres. I guess I'd like to ask you again about that. You know, they're like Russian dolls. One story is nestled within the other, not just the two stories of the book, but also in the sense that since you do tell the story of Brill from the first person, one has a sense of the author, your presence, despite the fact that this is fiction. As a reader, I experience the sense of you as the author in the book as well.
That's interesting, because it really is not an autobiographical work.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean that in that way at all, but more in the sense of perspective, that you're moving through different perspectives and that they're crossing, they're crossing the customary barriers that are usually erected. I mean, you've got plenty of stories within stories, but you don't usually have a story in which the character is out to kill the author of his story.
No, of course not. Well, I think for me, and it's something that it's an instinctive, intuitive decision, not a rational decision, you know, to construct a book in this way. It's it's an organic process, and it comes to you in the way it comes to you, and you go with it. But I do think that having a novel in which there is more than one story being told is, well, you talk about Russian dolls. Sometimes I think of it as a collage, and you have different elements on a canvas or on a piece of paper, and the spaces between those elements, if each element is interesting enough, it'll create a special kind of energy that will increase the interest of each individual component because you see it in relation to the others. So there's this kind of force field that's created. And so you're in a world of story, so to speak, and it's flexible and it's shifting. And I think it's something, well, it galvanizes me when I read something like that.
Well, Paul Auster, your story is Man in the Dark. Thanks so much for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
That was my 2008 interview with Paul Auster about his novel, Man in the Dark. He died April 30th at his home in Brooklyn. And we have some time left to read a poem. We're continuing our series of reading poems by Palestinian poet Mousab Abu Toha, when time allows, until a permanent ceasefire in Gaza is declared. As we speak, nearly 35,000 Palestinian civilians have been killed by Israeli forces, not counting the thousands who lie under the rubble of their destroyed homes. This is the poem, My Grandfather and Home. 1. My grandfather used to count the days for return with his fingers. He then used stones to count. Not enough. He used the clouds, birds, people. Absence turned out to be too long. 36 years until he died. For us now, it is over 70 years. My grandpa lost his memory. He forgot the numbers, the people. He forgot home. 2. I wish I were with you, Grandpa. I would have taught myself to write you poems, volumes of them, and paint our home for you. I would have sewn you from soil a garment decorated with plants and trees you had grown. I would have made you perfume from the oranges and soap from the skies, tears of joy. Couldn't think of something purer. 3. I go to the cemetery every day. I look for your grave, but in vain. Are they sure they buried you? Or did you turn into a tree? Or perhaps you flew with a bird to the nowhere? 4. I place your photo in an earthenware pot. I water it every Monday and Thursday at sunset. I was told you used to fast those days. In Ramadan, I water it every day for 30 days, or less, or more. 5. How big do you want our home to be? I can continue to write poems until you are satisfied. If you wish, I can annex a neighboring planet or two. 6. For this home, I shall not draw boundaries, no punctuation marks. That was My Grandfather and Home by Mousab Abu Toha. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.